How serious is the threat to U.S. cybersecurity?
It's very, very serious.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. And that is Joel Brenner, a former high-ranking member of the NSA, who says past presidents haven't taken cybersecurity seriously. So he's got new recommendations for the Trump administration.
A country that's not willing to defend the networks on which its security depends and safety depends is a nation that's just waiting for accidents to happen.
Plus, does the Democratic Party need to rethink how it talks about abortion? Boston College theologian Thomas Groom says yes.
If the Democrats are to have any hope of reclaiming the Senate, they can't just go on simply saying, we support Roe v. Wade.
And when a healthy, exercising non-smoker gets terminal cancer, who's to blame? A new study suggests that half the time, it's just awful luck. We'll find out why next on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If you care at all about cybersecurity, and I'm just going to assume that's everybody, you'll want to pay special attention to the conversation you're about to hear. Joel Brenner is one of the nation's leading cybersecurity experts. From 2006 to 2009, he was head of U.S. counterintelligence under the Director of National Intelligence. From 2002 to 2006, he was Inspector General for the National Security Agency. He's now a senior research fellow at MIT, splitting his time between the MIT Center for International Studies and the Computer Science and AI Lab. In other words, when Brenner says you should be worried about America's cybersecurity vulnerabilities, you should be very worried. So today, Brenner and other MIT researchers released a 50-page report full of recommendations to the White House. It's titled Keeping America Safe Toward More Secure Networks for Critical Sectors. And in it, Brenner says, now is the time for action. Joel Brenner, welcome to Radio Boston.
I'm delighted to be with you.
First of all, just describe to us, in your view, in your opinion, how grave is the cybersecurity threat to the United States right now?
It's very, very serious. We know that sophisticated attackers can take down the systems that power our electric grid, pipelines, railway switches, banks, and so on.
They have the means to do so today?
They have the means to do so today. And what's particularly troublesome is the likelihood that transnational terrorist and criminal organizations could also achieve the capacity to do that. I don't think they have yet. There's a certain deterrent effect among the large nation states, since if you try to do it to us, we could presumably do it to you as well or probably a lot better. But you can't deter transnational terrorist organizations or criminal organizations that way. And so I think this is a problem that's getting worse, not better. And the president in his executive order is going to deal, appears, only with the federal systems, which are also significantly vulnerable. And I understand that that's his first priority, but I'm concerned that privately owned critical infrastructure is again getting the short shrift. And we think that the report will complement the president's efforts because we are paying attention precisely to the problem of critical infrastructure.
Yeah. You know, so the patchwork between public and private stakeholders here is definitely a significant part of the challenge before us, and I want to talk with you about that in just a minute or two. But given your background and your area of expertise, I think anyone listening is rightfully feels a chill going down their spine to hear you say we are so vulnerable today. So what do you recommend? I mean, what's the top line recommendation you want to give to the White House on what the first thing the president should do?
Well, let me just take a step back from that question, because one of the things that we felt strongly was that it's taken us 25 years, Meghna, to back ourselves into this predicament, and we're not going to get out of it right away. And so we've focused on what can be done in a 5 to 7 year period. Now, immediately, we've suggested raising the profile of the what has been called the cybersecurity coordinator in the White House and making that person a deputy national security advisor. But then there are other certain things that won't be done right away but need immediate attention. Let me give you an example. We've concluded that critical infrastructure cannot be made more reasonably secure unless certain elements of those networks are removed from the public internet. It used to be a generation ago, if you wanted to get to the control on the switch on an Amtrak or a rail line, you had to go into a locked room that only the engineer could get into. Same thing if you wanted to get into the controls on a electric transmitting station. These controls were meant to be physically locked up. Now, we've made them electronic now. We've digitized them, and that's not likely to change. We haven't recommended it a change. But we have recommended that those parts of critical networks ought to be isolated from the public network.
So is another way of putting this, this might be a little too cliched, but to take critical parts of the grid off the grid?
Yep, precisely. Well, off the public
off
grid.
The off public the public grid, grid. Yeah.
You can have digital networks that aren't publicly accessible. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about. And people aren't going to want to hear that because it involves money. But we're talking about the health of the whole country. And we feel that these vulnerabilities have been known for so long and that a country that's not willing to defend the networks on which its security depends and safety depends is a nation that's just waiting for accidents to happen. That's not the way Americans have behaved in the past. And we need to fix it. I mean, I'll tell you a funny story. I went back to the first Bush administration, the 1990 George H.W. Bush, and I took key statements that each president since then has made about critical infrastructure, Bush, Clinton, Bush number two, and Obama, and I laid them out side by side to some of my friends, and I said, but I took the names and dates off, and I said, which one came first? Can't tell. Which president said which? Can't tell. So we've been listening to this echo chamber now for a long time. And we felt, all right, it's time to really get beyond aspirational happy talk, which is what we've been treated to for a long time, and shine a light on what the underlying problems are, both technological and commercial and political. And that's what we've tried to do in this report.
Do you think that we see a greater amount of will, political will now to do exactly that than we did before? Given, I mean, cybersecurity was a frequent talking point in the election. And for entirely different reasons, Americans are focused on cybersecurity now and the Trump administration. I mean, in a way, ironically, do you think that's focused our collective attention on the nation's vulnerabilities?
Well, I'm encouraged by that. Only a few years ago, you know, I was saying the things I'm saying to you now, and people were looking at me like, you know, what was I talking about? I think now the public really understands this is a serious problem. The public doesn't understand it in detail, nor would you expect it to. But what I'm hoping is that this president, who's certainly likes a bully pulpit, will use the bully pulpit now in dealing with the private sector. Because you can't just, the government just doesn't tell the private sector what to do. It has to work closely with it and design both positive and negative incentives for doing it. I mean, you know, negative incentives means liability. I mean, I can't think of any other area of life, Meghna, in which you can put into the stream of commerce hardware, software, applications, operating systems and whatnot that are insecure and have no liability for it.
Yeah, I mean, but we've already seen, as you well know, that that bad actors can weaponize the Internet of Things very quickly. I mean, that's happened already. So,
yes.
So I think folks who care to pay attention know that the vulnerabilities are there. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the specific recommendations that you make, because you know you touched on removing parts of critical infrastructure from the public grid or for public access points. Tell me what else. I mean, one of the things that I am particularly compelled by in your report is you identify that part of the challenge that we face is that government is really good at doing things in silos, right? The FEC regulates elections. The EPA does environment, but that cybersecurity, by definition, isn't something that we can effectively be siloed. How do we get over that problem?
Well, we have no serious problem now in government that doesn't involve more than one and often several big departments. And we've got to begin to learn to manage that. I think we recommend that, say, the secretaries of Homeland Security, Defense, and Energy get together to help create a market for more secure hardware and software for the critical infrastructure. Here, let me explain that problem. Right now, the computer chip in a control on a pipeline valve is probably the same chip in your kid's computer or in a game that's being played. It probably has 2 million lines of code in it, all in order to control a valve that is either open or shut or somewhere in between. Now, we know how to make simpler controls, which are less vulnerable, by the way, because nobody can find a sophisticated malware in 2 million lines of code. It's easy to hide, hard to find. But there isn't a market for that stuff.
Well, so the federal department's getting together to support a market. What exactly do you mean?
It means deciding that in the Defense Department, for example, we're going to buy and want you to make this kind of control instead of that kind of control, this kind of chip instead of that kind of chip.
Basically being an enormous customer. That would drive demand. Well, yeah.
They're an enormous customer, but and so to say, we will buy it if you make it, and we want you to make them available, you know, to private industry as well. And I'm not talking about, by the way, new software or hardware from scratch. That's a non-starter. I'm talking about making secure versions of chips in this case, or hardware and software based on a commercial off-the-shelf version.
So let me ask you, do you think we have the workforce or the future workforce, an adequate supply of scientists, engineers, and programmers to meet America's cybersecurity needs?
No, I think everyone agrees we don't. And the solution to that's difficult. I mean, we really need to train more Americans in computer science and electrical engineering than we're training. We don't have enough. So we got to get serious about this kind of training, and that's a matter of incentive. I hope you've noticed that in our report, we pay much more attention to incentives than we do to directives.
Right. I mean, so like tax incentives, for example.
Yeah. You know, a power company that's taken down is not going to be alone in paying the costs of that. The whole country or a big region of the country could close down for a time. Well, if that's the case and you want that company to internalize some of these costs, it maybe needs some tax incentives for making certain investments we would like them to make. Make them a little faster, retire legacy systems sooner. Other things we want to incentivize people not to put garbage into the market just because it's got bells and whistles and they're first to market with it, but it's insecure, like a lot of this IoT stuff. Well, maybe we have to rethink our liability.
So make those folks more liable.
Well, if you said to a company that you might be responsible to third parties for the foreseeable negative consequences of putting insecure stuff into the marketplace, you would change behaviors real fast.
Yeah. Joel Brenner, we just got a couple more minutes, and I just want to ask you two more quick questions here. The report is so provocative because you provocative in a good way, because these are questions we should be thinking about. I mean, you ask, for example, that in training a new generation of top-notch cybersecurity specialists in defensive capabilities, how much overlap is there between defensive training and offensive training? I mean, are you suggesting that the United States should also up its game in terms of its offensive use of cyber technology?
What we were suggesting there is based on our perception that if you don't know how to do offense, You can't do defense against the people who really are good at the offense. And that may suggest that we may want to train selective defenders in offensive tactics. Now, that's really a mouthful, because we don't want to start spreading around the knowledge of how to do a lot of these really sophisticated things, the kind of stuff NSA knows how to do, for example. But we might want to train and license a limited number of people to supplement what the government can do in this respect in order to bolster defenses mm-hmm. in critical infrastructure.
Have you had conversations with the White House?
I've been in touch with people in the White House. Let me just leave it at that. We are really hopeful that they will see our report as complementary to what they're doing. After 25 years of saying a lot and doing nothing on critical infrastructure, we can't let this infrastructure get short shrift again. That's why we focused on it and why we're hopeful.
Hope is
cheap.
And never the best of all strategies. Let me ask you, though. I mean, you said earlier that the United States has done a good job in the past of being prepared and thinking about what the nation's going to need for the future. I sometimes, I'll be perfectly honest, in the many conversations I've had with folks who are deeply concerned about cybersecurity, I come away from these conversations thinking, yes, but are we in a situation where the one thing that's really going to focus the nation's mind and attention on how critical this need is a disaster, is a large-scale attack that just shows us how vulnerable we are? Are you concerned about that?
I confess I have had the same thoughts. Let's just hope that if something bad happens, it's bad enough to make us change our ways and not bad enough to cause us horrible, horrible problems. You know, Americans really wake up and decide to do something, nobody's better at it. But getting our attention for something that's beyond our private good or bad is difficult. And that's the dilemma we've got now.
Joel Brenner, he's former Inspector General of the National Security Agency and head of the U.S. Counterintelligence in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. He's also principal author on this new report and recommendations on cybersecurity for the United States. We'll have a link to that at radioboston.org. Joel Brenner, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Pay attention. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Eat right, exercise regularly, don't smoke, don't drink a lot of alcohol, stay away from drugs. That is the equation for being healthy. But if that's the case, then who's to blame when a healthy eating, non-smoking, frequent exerciser gets a terminal cancer diagnosis? Well, that is what happened to a friend of Dick Knox. He's senior correspondent for WBUR's Common Health blog, and he's written a piece about his experience. It's titled, A Friend Dies as Scientists Ponder Just How Preventable Are Most Cancers. And he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome back to the show, Dick.
Thanks, Meghna.
Well, first of all, tell us about the impetus, or at least part of the impetus for this piece. It was the death of one of your close friends, right?
Yes. I and many of her friends were reeling lately because our friend was just the most vital, vigorous, healthy living person you could imagine. She liked to climb mountains and clear trails, hike the Himalayas, all the 4,000 footers in New Hampshire, I'm told, more than once, that kind of person. And so she's sort of the last person that many people would expect to get sick from anything, but especially lung cancer. Uh-huh. She didn't smoke. So that's why I've been sort of primed to wonder just how this comes about.
Wow. Well, then at the same time that this news about your friend was going on in your life, there's this paper that comes out in the Journal of Science about how someone like your friend, who never smoked, very healthy, could get this kind of cancer, or could get an unexpected cancer, right?
Exactly, yeah. In fact, the timing, as often happens, in life. It was coincidental. She died Tuesday night of last week, and I found out Wednesday morning. That afternoon, I had to dial into a press briefing to discuss this new paper that was being published the next day in Science by one of the leading lights of science research, Dr. Bert Vogelstein of Johns Hopkins. So I was sitting in this press conference listening to him talk about his latest research and thinking, wow, this is probably what happened to my friend.
Hmm. Well, first of all, Dick, let me just say that I am so sorry to hear that your friend just passed away last week.
Yes, and she had a very fast terminal illness. She got the diagnosis of lung cancer in December and went downhill very quickly despite suffering the debilitating effects of all the best therapy. Mm.
Well, tell us more about what this paper has found or seems to suggest, that something as upwards of, what, half of cancers, they say, may be unpreventable?
Probably around half. What they found was that they looked at cancers in many countries, dozens of countries representing something like half the world's populations. They looked at the mutations that are found in these cancers. They also looked at a whole bunch of different kinds of cancers. And they found that about 2 out of 3 mutations that are found in these cancer cells are due not to the environment, which includes behavioral factors such as bad diet and smoking, not due to hereditary genes that we know about and can cause cancer, but due to these what they call replicative errors. These are every time a cell divides, then it makes a mistake, makes several mistakes, like 3 per cell division on average. Most of these are harmless. Sometimes they occur in a part of the DNA that either is supposed to suppress a cancer or it will drive a cancer. And so these are these random bad luck events that when they pile up over time can put you on the road to cancer.
Hmm. And just to underscore, this was a pretty expansive study, right? 17 different cancer types, almost 70 countries.
Right. And the criticism they got back in 2015 when they first proposed this was that they only looked at U.S. Cases, and obviously lots of countries have much different environments than we do, so people could be exposed to more environmental toxins. And secondly, that they didn't include some big cancers like prostate and breast cancer. They corrected those they addressed those criticisms in this new paper. So it's more persuasive. It should be. We'll see how controversial it becomes.
Well, I imagine that it will be very controversial, right? Because to hear that there seems to be some evidence that half of cancers are not preventable goes against so much of what doctors have been telling people for, you know, a generation, if not generations, right? Eat better, exercise, don't smoke, all of those things. And haven't there been studies that show that, you know, people who do exercise more in certain cases show a lower prevalence of certain cancers?
Well, the exercise evidence is iffy. Mm. But clearly doing all these healthy things probably does lower your risk of cancer. I think the controversy is really one of a question of emphasis. How much is due to the environment? How much is due to heredity? Probably around 5 to 10%. How much is due to these random errors that happen? So it's a mixed picture, and it probably works out to something like a half of cancers are due to these random errors.
So that's a very important point, I think, Dick, because for as long as there is a mix, it's not a set percentage for any one particular person, right? We can't say that this 50% of people got their cancers because of these random genetic mutations, and that 50% got their cancers because of behavioral or environmental. I mean, it's never going to be as clear as that.
No, although scientists are making a lot of progress in determining the genetics of individual patients' cancers. So they probably can say these are the kind of mutations that come from smoking. These are the kind of cancers that come from the BRCA gene or whatever. And these we just don't know. It's probably just mutational error.
So those are research questions yet to be answered, right?
Absolutely. There's lots of questions that this raises.
What about the philosophical implications or maybe not even philosophical, but just the sheer emotional implications for patients who might hear this? Because I imagine there might be a lot of people who are trying to rack their brains if they get a diagnosis thinking, what did I do?
I think it's always the first question, not just with cancer, is why me? I mean, what could I have done differently? What's going on here? Especially if you thought you were living a healthy life. So Dr. Vogelstein and his team hope, they say, that this will help alleviate that self-blame and that guilt. It's especially acute for parents of children who get cancer. Mm-hmm. Vogelstein says that most childhood cancers, great majority of childhood cancers, are due to these random errors. Mm.
But just to underscore again, no one's saying that that doctors should stop recommending to people that they don't smoke or that they do eat healthy, more healthy foods, and they continue to try to do as much exercise.
Absolutely not. And I think the real, as I said earlier, the real question is how much emphasis it deserves to be put on environmental toxins or behavior or random bad luck or genetics. Another team of researchers thinks that perhaps 10% to 30% of cancer, all cancers, may be due to these bad luck hits to the genome. But nobody is saying that people shouldn't do the things we know will reduce your risk of cancer.
So finally, Dick, the point about not blaming oneself is an important one. But are there other major takeaways for people, you know, listening to this?
Well, I think the obvious question that did get raised is, well, okay, so what can I do to prevent these random mutation things? And the answer is probably nothing, at least nothing we know of now. You just need to identify them as early as possible and treat them as early and as well as possible. That opens up a whole other we could talk about that another time, because sometimes early identification of cancers causes more harm than good. If you identify cancer that is never going to kill you, there's no nice strategy that this suggests that you can prevent these bad luck cancers. Mm.
Such a complex disease.
It is. We're learning more and more, and the more we learn, the more complicated it gets.
Well, Dick Knox is a senior correspondent for WBUR's Common Health blog. His recent post is titled, "A Friend Dies as Scientists Ponder Just How Preventable Are Most Cancers." We have a link to it at radioboston.org. Dick, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Meghna.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the past 65 years, American Catholics have largely been seen as a reliable Democratic vote. In fact, Republican presidential candidates won slight majorities of the Catholic vote only four times from 1952 to 2012. But in 2016, Hillary Clinton lost the overall Catholic vote by 7 points, and she lost the white Catholic vote by 23 points. Thomas Groom says that significant shift is largely due to one thing. Catholics now view Democrats as unconditionally supporting abortion. He asks in a recent New York Times op-ed what, if anything, Democrats can do to win those Catholics back. Groom is professor of theology at Boston College's School of Theology and Ministry. He's director of the Church in the 21st Century Center and also author of What Makes Us Catholic. And he joins us now. Welcome back to the program, Professor Groom.
Thank you, Meghna. Happy to be here.
It's really great to have you. I actually want to begin our conversation in a place that you highlight in your New York Times op-ed at the third presidential debate between
yes.
Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. This was the one that happened at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. You say it's very illustrative of the problem for Democrats that you raise. And I want to just
yes.
play some tape here, because there was a moment where in that debate, the candidates, Clinton and Trump, were asked about abortion. And here's how Hillary Clinton answered.
I strongly support Roe v. Wade, which guarantees a constitutional right to a woman to make the most intimate, most difficult in many cases, decisions about her health care that one can imagine.
And here's how then-candidate Donald Trump answered, criticizing Clinton's position on abortion.
Based on where she's going and where she's been, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb in the 9th month, on the final day, and that's not acceptable.
Thomas Groom, you say that that's a very telling moment.
It was, Meghna. Well, because if we played on that tape, Secretary Clinton did not come back and rebut the caricature that Mr. Trump had portrayed. She should have come back and said, as of 2003, by federal law, partial birth abortion, which he had just described, is against the law in this country. 43 of our states have serious time limits to abortion, that after 21 weeks, they're not allowed. So that he had caricatured her position. And the tragedy was that she didn't come back and say, that's not where I stand. So my point, Meghna, in many ways, it's not to analyze why Hillary lost or how she could have won, but rather going forward to say that Democrats constantly underrepresent their position around abortion. And if I could for a moment, Ronald Reagan campaigned on a pro-life platform, got into office, and the abortion spiked. Bill Clinton campaigned on a pro-choice, got into office, and the abortions dropped precisely because he provided. Reagan had cut the social services. Clinton had restored many of them. So there's a direct correlation between abortion and poverty. Women below the poverty line are 300% more likely to have abortions than women above it. So if we provide decent social services, then we can greatly reduce the numbers of abortion. That's what's happened under President Reagan, that from 2009 to 2014, the abortion rate is down something like 22%. Under Obama, is down something like 22%. So that when voters, I was watching that show with somebody who turned to me and said, "Well, there goes 5 million votes."
And she was a Catholic, a fellow Catholic?
Yes. Okay. And a lot of those votes were in the swing states. It didn't matter much to Massachusetts or to Georgia. But it did matter in Pennsylvania and in Florida and in Wisconsin and in Michigan that the swing vote is the Catholic vote. And I think she lost a lot of them in underrepresenting her position.
Professor Grunlow, so let me respectfully disagree with you a little bit.
Please.
On this. Because I feel as if maybe a challenge that some Democratic candidates, and particularly Hillary Clinton, faced is not so much that they weren't talking in a more nuanced way about abortion, or that they weren't acknowledging the moral profundities that come along with abortion, but perhaps that when they did, they weren't heard. And here's why I say this. Because, I mean, you say that Hillary Clinton didn't respond when Donald Trump caricatured her view of late-term abortion, but we went back and actually looked at the tape, and literally, after Trump made that caricature of late-term abortion, Hillary Clinton did speak immediately after that. Now, she didn't say anything about late-term abortion, but she did say this.
Using that kind of scare rhetoric is just terribly unfortunate. You should meet with some of the women that I've met with, women I've known over the course of my life. This is one of the worst possible choices that any woman and her family has to make. And I do not believe the government should be making it.
So let me ask you, Professor, I mean, is that not enough of a nuanced or emotional or moral approach?
Well, I wish she would have said, we will continue to make it legal, we will continue to make it safe, but we will also work to make it very rare. And we can reduce it. I didn't expect her to come back in favor of limiting abortion. That's not her position. But she could have come back in favor of reducing it. So to me, Meghna, again, to respectfully disagree, that was not a sufficient rebuttal of what, because Trump had very graphically described this. It was like shocking to listen to. And for her to not have come back and say, well, she came back and said, well, in favor of a woman's right to choose and so on. But it's got bygones. So in a sense,
this is really important.
The looking back is not, I don't think, as fruitful as looking forward.
Indeed, but we can only looking forward. Point taken. But I do want to sort of dwell a little looking back, because I guess my question to you has to do with when Democrats have spoken about abortion with greater nuance, or spoken about abortion and acknowledged. I mean, you point to President Obama as having, during his campaigns,
yes,
having spoken with more moral gravitas.
As a moral issue, not just purely legal.
And that reached the concerns of Catholic voters.
It does, because, you see, it is, in fact, a moral issue. It's a legal issue. But I think to speak about it with a deep empathy for women who have tragically to make the choice and so on, which I want to do always, and lots of my emails in response to that essay, you know, have reminded me of how little I know about pregnancy, especially as a man. So I don't want in any way to dismiss the complexity of it, the pain of it, the bewilderment of it all. But I think to get the Dutch of about one half of our abortion rate, and it's all because they have better social services than we have. They also have better health, better availability of birth control means, and so on. So there are ways that we can reduce this. But it seems to me that Democrats are so intent on simply coming out and say, "I support Roe v. Wade." Now, whether people know it or not, but the stereotype of that is that I'm in favor of unconditional abortion anytime, any place, and this is what Trump put on Hillary, upon Secretary Clinton,
right.
And she didn't disown it sufficiently enough to in my view.
I mean, to be fair to Secretary Clinton, the question Chris Wallace had asked in that at that moment in the debate was, "Would you overturn Roe v. Wade in the Supreme Court?" I mean, it was a question
point
specifically
well
about
yeah.
about the case.
Yeah.
But so you point to President Obama and a quotation he had about abortion in one of his presidential campaigns, where he said, "Those who diminish the moral elements of the decision aren't expressing the full reality." As a demonstration of the kind of language, the kind of engagement that you'd like to see more.
And the recognition that it is more than just a right. It's a complex moral issue that is very painfully made.
Yeah. Well, and I point back to that specifically because, again, maybe this has more to do with Hillary Clinton than Democrats as a whole, because in 2008... the year she ran against Barack Obama in the Democratic primaries. She spoke at Messiah College. And in fact, you know, you said that in the Trump debate, she didn't talk about keeping abortion legal, safe and rare. But that was literally the language she used in 2008. Again,
yes.
Here's Hillary Clinton at Messiah College in the Democratic primary.
"I think abortion should remain legal, but it needs to be safe and rare. And I have spent many years now as a private citizen, as First Lady, and now as Senator, trying to make it rare, trying to create the conditions where women had other choices. I have supported adoption, foster care, and I think we have to do even more."
That's Hillary Clinton in 2008. Professor Groom, why is it that when Democrats say things like this, or again, or maybe it's just Hillary Clinton, that the caricature that you pointed to earlier is still the one that seems to overpower the authentic things that the candidates are saying?
And Meghna, to hear her say what she just said at that college just breaks my heart. What didn't she say at that night? I think it could have made, it was a turning point. Now, I could be wrong. But my impression, and I've talked to lots of friends about this, but my impression, purely anecdotal, is that turning point in the debate was at that third debate when she didn't come back and say what she said in other contexts. Mm-hmm. And the tragedy is that indeed what we've just heard her say is her position. And I believe that. But I run into Democrats all the time who are afraid to talk about it. Now, having looked at my own emails this past week, I understand why they are. It's such a tense topic that is the last thing we can talk about, in a sense. And yet, there's so much division. Like, 80% of our country does not want to criminalize abortion again. On the other hand, 60% is opposed to abortions after the 21st week. So, if we could ever find a middle ground, and if we ever could provide the kind of social services, the kind of sex education, and so on, that we could cut this rate significantly. The Dutch have done it. The Germans have done it. The Swedes have done it. We can do it as well. But that's not how the Democrats come out and talk about it. They talk about it just simply as, "We support Roe v. Wade," and that is so misheard still in our context. It's such a loaded symbol.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, I disagree with you. I don't think the Democrats just come out and talk about it in terms of Roe v. Wade, and when they do, it's because they've been forced to, because we've been come through, you know, basically since the 80s, a political generation where, you know, it's not uncommon to hear candidates being asked about a litmus test for Supreme Court nominees about Roe v. Wade. You know, so is it so much? I fear we're going in circles here, but maybe that's because my own lack of understanding in terms of what you're actually saying. Is it how the nation really talks about abortion, or is it how Democrats talk about abortion?
See, I wish we would take Roe v. Wade out of the conversation in a sense, start a new conversation.
Yeah.
Because in effect, 43 of our states already have limits in place. I mean, Roe v. Wade, if it stood alone without any conditions, is the most liberal abortion law in the world. Now, in fact, 43 of our states have put limits in place, significant limits. Our federal government has put a limit in place against partial birth abortion. So in a sense, we've moved beyond what most people associate. In practice, we've moved beyond Roe v. Wade. And I suppose I'd love to see Democratic politicians talk about it that way and imagine ways to continue to reduce the number, to make funds available. I mean, Colorado has a fascinating experiment in place for the last 5 or 6 years where they've provided effective birth control measures and the abortion rate and the unwanted pregnancy rate is down drastically.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways to do this, but I suppose I so seldom hear the Democratic Party talking about it that way. And even when you look at their platform for the presidential, I mean, they took on the Hyde Amendment to oppose it, which I thought was just the wrong signal to be giving. There was no nuance whatsoever in the Democratic platform in the last presidential election. There was in the previous one around adoption, around abortion, that they would favor adoption and so on, the kind of things that Hillary just said. That was absent from the last from the platform of the party running in the last presidential election. So it was almost as if we were just, I don't know, moving beyond the nuance or something.
Yeah. You know, so I don't want this conversation, anyone listening to this conversation, to come away thinking that we're talking about Catholics as a monolith, right? Because there's no single group of American voters that can be universally defined by one issue. But you are still saying that this conversation about abortion is important to American Catholics.
It is important. I think it's important to all American people. And I think any thinking person has to be somewhat reflective about it. I think my own tradition has been very strongly pro-life and opposed to abortion. Now, Catholicism is as diverse as Protestantism or as Judaism. You know, we have all kinds of the left, right and center Catholics as we have various different Protestant denominations.
But you voted for Hillary Clinton anyway.
Yes, I did, because my bishops, not that I had permission from my bishops, but the Catholic bishops make clear that we don't have to be single-issue voters, that we can look at the whole program or policies of a politician and make a prudential judgment, as they call it. And indeed, while we're not supposed to vote for them because they're in favor of abortion, we can vote for them in spite of the fact that they're in favor of abortion for other good reasons, on immigration, the environment, and all the other reasons why I voted for her and happily voted for her. But I just wish that to my friends in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Florida and the Catholics, it's a swing vote. In she lost Michigan by what, 0.03%.
Right.
I mean, a handful of Catholic votes would have won her that state. And I think the Catholic vote, you know, the blue states vote blue, the red states vote red. The swing vote in the swing state, in many of the swing states, is the Catholic vote. So that if she wanted to appeal to that, then she had to do more than she did in that third debate.
It makes me wonder, though, isn't it also possible that many American Catholics have just become more conservative over time and that they were never, and here's why I ask, because, you point out in your own New York Times op-ed that part of the shift may be because many American Catholic bishops did emphasize cultural issues, the culture wars, as you put it, abortion, gay marriage, for so long, that was a major part of the Catholic conversation in this country.
That's true. That is true. I mean, and good Catholics who followed their bishops and lots of parishes and what have you. I think there were parishes who very, not so subtly, encouraged Catholics to vote for Mr. Trump because of the abortion issue. And I encounter them in my own Sunday Mass attendance and participation, situations where the priest would never say that in his sermon, but he would remind us, you know, of the teachings of our church about the sacredness of life beginning with conception and so on, and you got the message. And there were bishops who did that in this past election. But generally speaking, I think anybody would agree that our American Catholic bishops over the last 25, 30 years, the ones appointed by Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict, tended to be more conservative, not just theologically, but politically. And I do think they led us in a turn to the right socially as well as otherwise. And I think some of that rubbed off on Catholic voters. And in a sense, I think if long life to him, but if Pope Francis gets a good run and if somebody like him is elected after him, I think we will see a shift in Catholic voting patterns. Not that people will abandon these issues, because as I said, it is kind of deep for us. It's almost like I say in the essay, it's like saying to a group of Quakers, I'm in favor of war without even stating conditions or preconditions. So that it is a deep issue for us, even those of us who have perhaps moved to a more mediated or a more moderate position on it, it's still a lingering ethical, moral issue and a spiritual issue.
Well, I want to play another piece of tape for you because a little earlier today we spoke with Lou Murray. He's a Massachusetts resident. He's actually been on our show several times. And he served on President Trump's National Catholic Advisory Committee during the election. He read your New York Times op-ed, Professor Groom. And so we asked Lou Murray for his reaction to your piece. Obviously, he voted for Donald Trump because he advised the Trump campaign. And here's what Lou Murray said.
Most Catholics would agree with the Archbishop of Colorado, who came out and said that the overriding moral issue for Catholics when deciding who to vote for is abortion. Those who diminish the moral elements of the decision aren't expressing it in the full reality, was President Obama's quote. And I just think you can't nuance this issue.
Professor Groom, it's that last part of what Lou said about, in his view, you can't nuance the issue.
And he's saying he's more Catholic than the Catholic bishops of the country. He's more Catholic than the bishops, because our bishops say you can nuance it. In their document on informed citizenship, they state very clearly that while you cannot vote for somebody because they're in favor of abortion, you can vote for them in spite of the fact that they're in favor of abortion because of their position on other issues. In other words, you can make a prudential judgment and weigh the variables and come to it. I say, well, I disagree with his or her position on abortion, but I love their position on immigration or on the environment or on care for the poor or, you know, heating oil for poor people in New England in the wintertime or whatever it is that your passion might be, you can make a prudential judgment. So Catholics don't have to. The Archbishop of Colorado, of Denver, I believe he said, is one of our more conservative Catholic bishops in the country. And it doesn't surprise me that he would come down and say that. But he wasn't the only one who did that. A number of our bishops, I know, would have done the same thing. A number of our priests in our parishes.
Is it possible that we're misreading this moment entirely and that the truth is that American Catholics or many American Catholics, like countless, well, not countless, we know, millions of other voters just felt that regardless of what their views are on abortion, that issues of the economy, of immigration,
sure,
of the populist rhetoric and notes that Donald Trump was hitting spoke to them more?
Yes, but some of the other stuff he was saying, you know, his misogyny, his xenophobia, his disrespect for women, his disrespect for the truth should have caused any conscientious Christian or Jew or whoever, any person of any ethic, not to vote for him. So why did so many Catholics vote for him? Swing away. The Catholics that President Obama had won went away. Secretary Clinton won the Hispanic vote by less percentage than President Obama had. So why the significant shift when she was a wonderful woman, could have been our first woman president, so much in sync with Catholic social teaching on so many issues, a great, decent and experienced person? Why would we not have voted for her? That's what I'm trying to find out. And sure, jobs and the economy and his talk about terrorism and all that was important to us. But to me, the one I think where we faltered was around the abortion issue, especially in those swing states, which even by way of compared to Massachusetts Catholics, I think it'd be fair to say might tend to be a little more traditional.
So there's one more thing or two more things actually I want to ask you, because a couple of months ago, also in the New York Times, Ross Douthat, the New York Times columnist, he wrote about a populism versus, I don't know what you call it, conservatism in the United States versus that same divide within the Catholic Church itself. And he said that in his view, it's Pope Francis within the world of Catholics who's the populist, whereas obviously Donald Trump would be the populist in the American context. But I just want to read one quick
Please.
Thing here and get your reaction to it. He says that that Pope Francis may be making a traditionalist critique of the entire post-Vatican II church, and that in fact, basically he says that Rostow that says that the younger Catholic right in America is already more skeptical of modernity than the Pope John Paul II generation, and that Pope Francis may be at risk of pushing them even further right in America. What's your thought?
I think that's wishful thinking on Ross's part. I don't think there's any substance to that whatsoever. I mean, you can play games with those names. I mean, sure, Pope Francis is a populist the way that Bernie Sanders was a populist. But there's no correlation at all between what Pope Francis is saying and that type of conservative restorationist Catholicism.
Mm-hmm. Well, Thomas Groom is the professor of theology and religious education at Boston College's School of Theology and Ministry. He's director of the Church of the 21st Century Center, and he's also author of What Makes Us Catholic. We have a link to his New York Times op-ed at our website, radioboston.org. Professor Groom, thanks so much for joining us
today. Thank you for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.